This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
People take to the streets of the southwestern Yemeni city of Taiz to denounce the French president's anti-Islam comments. U.S. National Guard troops are deployed in the city of Philadelphia following unrest sparked by the police killing of an African-American man. And several countries in Europe impose tough restrictions to fight the coronavirus pandemic as the number of cases keep surging across the continent. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, thousands of Yemenis have held a fresh protest against the French president, Emmanuel Macron, for his anti-Islam stance. Demonstration was held in the southern city of Taiz. The protesters condemned Macron's Islamophobic remarks, calling on all Muslim nations to unite and boycott French products. Macron outraged the Muslim world by defending the publication of insulting cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad under the pretext of the freedom of expression. This came after a teacher was beheaded by one of his students for showing blasphemous caricatures. A suspect has been arrested after a Greek Orthodox priest was shot and seriously wounded in the French city of Lyon. Local authorities and prosecutors said the person's motives were unclear. Police said they could not confirm whether the person they have is the assailant. A source with the local prosecutors in Lyon said that they've opened a probe into this matter. On Thursday, three people were killed in a knife attack in the city of Nice. French officials described that attack as an act of terror. Political commentator Shabri Hassanandi says the Macron stance is part of the Islamophobia campaign, which is aimed at demonizing Muslims.
This episode shows the extreme political immaturity of Macron. It shows that he has no real intelligence. He doesn't understand how politics works in the world. And he somehow thinks just pointing the finger at Muslims after he himself has insulted the sensitivities and the sanctities of more than 2 billion people across the world. If these people had any honor and any dignity, and if they really stood behind this idea of so-called freedom of expression and freedom of speech, there are other subjects that if I mention right now, I will be in a lot of trouble. People have gone to jail for mentioning these other subjects. But insulting the prophet of more than 2 million people, someone who was sent as a mercy to humanity, this is somehow considered very brave and very secular and very wonderful by this immature child. This is not something that is isolated. It's not something that's just come out of Charlie Hebdo or Macron. This is something that has been part of the industry of Islamophobia that has been rampant for many, many years now, that has been demonizing Muslims in a way historically other communities were demonized, which ultimately led to atrocities the likes of which we can't even talk about. Terrorist attacks where people are harmed, people are killed. These have nothing to do with Islam. These have nothing to do with any religion.
A nighttime curfew has once again been imposed in the U.S. city of Philadelphia amid ongoing protests over the police killing of an African-American man there. Earlier, we discussed the matter in length with our guests in our news review program. The U.S. city of Philadelphia has been put under nighttime curfew again amid ongoing protests over the fatal police shooting of an African-American man. Now, this is the second time that the curfew has been imposed in Philadelphia this week. National Guard troops have already been deployed there, with the mayor saying forces will also be sent to critical government buildings and other infrastructure. The demonstrations began Monday after 27-year-old Walter Wallace was killed by two officers who claimed he was approaching them with a knife. Victim's family, though, says that he was suffering from mental issues. Since then, more than 200 people have been arrested and a number of officers injured. Some businesses say that they've been looted and vandalized throughout the rallies. and now joining us for this news review is Colin Campbell, joining us from Washington, D.C., and Walter Smolarlik, editor at Liberation News, joining us out of Philadelphia. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. What's going on, Colin? Give us this latest, if you could.
Yeah, so the National Guard has been deployed in Philadelphia. They say that they're there to protect buildings ahead of the elections, which will be on November 3rd. And if you've seen just how some of these protests have played out, we have seen a number of times when there are provocateurs or saboteurs or vandals that accompany some of these protests, either just trying to discredit the movement themselves or just trying to create mayhem to create more disturbance than what is necessary. And so as a measure, a defense measure, or some would say a proactive measure, these National Guard troops have been deployed around the city, setting up staging areas in case that the protesting escalates to a level of either looting or rioting or some type of vandalism where property is definitely threatened and people's lives are threatened.
Thank you, Colin. And Walter Smolarlik, welcome to the program, bud. Hope you're doing well. Now, Walter, we have two things going on here. We have the ongoing protests we've seen for months against police brutality, against people of color, and excessive use of force by U.S. police against people of color. And then we have the politicization of the rallies themselves, what Colin just alluded to, especially now that we're getting really close to Election Day. Your thoughts on all the stuff going on at the same time here?
That's right. I mean, it's truly a remarkable confluence of events. I mean, here you have the wanton murder of Walter Wallace Jr. by Philadelphia police officers, and the Philadelphia Police Department has a long history and notorious record of brutality against Black residents of Philadelphia. Listeners might be familiar with, for instance, the MOVE bombing in the 1980s. But yeah, I mean, this is something that is systemic and entrenched in Philadelphia and expressed itself in a horrific way when Walter Wallace Jr. was gunned down in front of his mother, who was pleading with police officers not to shoot. And yes, that's right. I mean, this comes a few days before Election Day. And Pennsylvania, I mean, could very well be the state that decides the election. Donald Trump has made, quote unquote, law and order a central feature of his reelection campaign. He's promising to crack down, to be tough, so to speak, against people who are exercising their right to protest against racism. He's completely embraced the police. And so this is something that he's predictably trying to politically capitalize on ahead of Tuesday's election.
And Colin, what does Donald Trump tell his supporters that the radical liberals and the radical left, they support the looters and agitators and vandals out in the streets, and they want to defund your police and basically to care nothing about your safety, right?
That's right, and this is a political strategy on behalf of the president and his administration to demonize those who are trying to assert some type of feeling of self-determination or feeling those who feel they are marginalized by law enforcement or justice systems that are in place that are supposed to be designed to protect people. Also, the mischaracterization of defunding the police, quote-unquote, is also rampant when trying to use it as a political talking point. As many people know who are familiar with the phrase actually means, it doesn't mean to get rid of the police. It means to reallocate funds that are given to police to possibly better organizations, agencies, or departments so that they can respond to calls commensurate with the level of attention that is needed for a safe outcome for those involved. So if you look at the situation with Walter Wallace, the 911 was the call for 911 was placed because he was having an episode. They really were hoping that an ambulance would show up, a medical professional would show up, someone who could de-escalate the situation and attend to Mr. Wallace in a way that would lead to a safe outcome. Instead, the police were called, and as they say, if you're a carpenter, every problem that you face looks like a nail, and then you respond by hitting it with a hammer. Well, this is what the police did. And yes, Walter Wallace was reported to have a knife, but it's very unclear Well, I wouldn't say it's very unclear, but it is very much disputed whether or not police had to fatally shoot him. There are number of episodes and scenarios where we've seen people with a dangerous weapon in their hand, not a firearm, mind you, where things were de-escalated and the person was either given attention medically or the situation was then diluted. But in this case, of course, they just decided to shoot because that's what they're trained to do.
Thank you, Colin. Walter, your final thoughts on this, please.
Well, I think that, you know, the protests are going to continue in Philadelphia and all across the country. I mean, we can't forget that this is connected with one of the most important political dynamics in the country, and that's the ongoing uprising against racism and police brutality that I think has become a defining feature of politics and political discussion and in fact the broader society of the United States. I mean, we really can't overemphasize, I think, the importance of the fact that while these problems are not new, the problems of police brutality are not new, the response of people to it has so much energy behind it, and I think that's something that will be very, very long lasting.
And it's something that's been lost in the message in Donald Trump's camp and with his supporters, unfortunately. But thank you for bringing that back into the forefront. Thank you, gentlemen. We're out of time. Both of you, I'd like to thank you for joining us on the program. And do stay safe. Colin Campbell from Washington, D.C., and Walter Smolarek joining us there from Philly. That's a wrap for this segment of your News Review. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now. Now in the U.S., the number of guns being sold has surged to record levels this year. Research shows Americans are stocking up on firearms amid a year of racial tensions, and it all comes just days before the country's presidential election.
A new study has shown that so far in 2020, Americans have purchased at least 17 million firearms. According to Small Arms Analytics, this is more than any other single year since records began. Gun sales across the country had already seen a surge in the spring because of the coronavirus pandemic, but they spiked even higher in the summer of widespread protests and anger over systematic racism. The demonstrations began following the police killing of an African-American, George Floyd. Small Arms Analytics says by August, the US had exceeded last year's total. By September, the US exceeded the highest total ever. It added that the number of guns sold through the end of September 2020 is not only more than last year, it's more than any full year in the last 20 years we have records for. The revelation clearly highlights the levels of unrest the United States has witnessed this year.
There's been a tremendous amount of unrest here in the United States. There has been the Black Lives Matter movement. There's killings almost every day of black people by police and by white supremacists. So there's a real sense of panic among certain parts of the population.
According to the analytics company, the previous record for estimated firearms sold in a single year was 16.6 million. That was in 2016, when Hillary Clinton ran for president against Donald Trump and endorsed a strong gun control platform.
The United States has set a new worldwide record for confirmed COVID-19 cases in a single day, reporting over 100,000 new infections. Latest data indicates the U.S. is now recording more than one case every second. 31 states have also set records for an increase of infections. And on Friday, more than a dozen U.S. states reported their highest one-day coronavirus cases, while 13 states were at record levels of hospitalizations. Over 9.1 million Americans have so far been infected by the coronavirus. Disease has also claimed more than 230,000 lives in the country. The U.K. has announced a nationwide lockdown amid a second wave of the coronavirus outbreak, which threatens to strain the health service.
And so now is the time to take action because there is no alternative. And from Thursday until the start of December, you must stay at home. You may only leave home for specific reasons, including for education, for work, let's say if you cannot work from home, for exercise and recreation outdoors with your household or on your own with one person from another household, for medical reasons, appointments, and to escape injury or harm, to shop for food and essentials, and to provide care for vulnerable people or as a volunteer.
Johnson added that all non-essential retail stores will close down, but there'll be no need for citizens to stock up. Stringent measures come as the country's confirmed COVID-19 infections exceeded 1 million, with over 20,000 cases being reported daily. Tougher restrictions were also announced in several European countries, including Portugal and Austria. Greece is also on the verge of a partial lockdown. Meanwhile, France logged over 35,000 infections in a 24-hour period, raising its overall cases to 1.3 million. Over 36,000 people have so far died from the disease in France. Now, Europe accounts for half of the global totals of infections, with over an average of 240,000 infections per day. Tai Puruza joined us earlier with more on Britain's nationwide lockdown.
Is we're going to look at this nationwide lockdown going to play in place on Thursday in 5 days' time, and we're looking at non-essential shops and businesses closing. For example, the hairdressers, those in the entertainment, the hospitality sector, pubs, they're going to have to shut down for the whole month. But schools, nurseries, colleges, and essential businesses will remain open for the next month. It is also important to mention that this is all happening as the so-called furlough scheme that supported people, companies rather, to keep their employees in employment by covering two-thirds of their wages. That was supposed to end at the end of October, and now the government has said that it's extending it throughout November. But again, what is going to happen is these measures will have to be voted upon in Parliament.
Israelis have held fresh demonstrations against Premier Benjamin Netanyahu in Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Protesters gathered just outside his home to condemn his policies and once again call for his resignation. Scuffles broke out after several people were arrested. The demonstrations came despite a ban on protests. Israelis have been staging street rallies in recent months to protest soaring unemployment, a hike in COVID-19 infections, and a return of coronavirus restrictions. Adding to anti-regime sentiments are corruption charges facing the prime minister. Netanyahu went on trial in May for bribery, fraud, and breach of trust, but denies any wrongdoing. India-controlled Kashmir has shut down to protest India's amendments and repeal of its decades-old land laws. The move has opened up after Kashmir's land for sale to all Indian citizens. Shahana Butt reports.
A shutdown is being observed in Indian-controlled Kashmir after New Delhi amended and repealed a series of decades-old land laws of Kashmir. The new reorganization law issued on October 26, 2020, opens up all of Jammu and Kashmir to every Indian citizen and removes every restriction that prevented large land holdings. Allows the Indian armed forces to take over land wherever they desire and gives sweeping powers to the government to take over any land and property for industrial use and bring in big businesses to set up their shops. People's Democratic Party President Mehbooba Mufti, while criticizing the government's move, accused India of land grab for big investors. The October 26, 2020 order repealed 13 state laws and amends 14 laws. Experts say this is to further the agenda behind the abrogation. According to historic date check, these laws were introduced to empower the majority Muslims who were suffering immensely under the non-Muslim rulers. Not only this, but the rights to buy and sell land in Kashmir were also confined to the people of Kashmir. Experts say India's move in Kashmir since August 5, 2019 has further internationalized this conflict. In response to the shutdown call by Pro-Freedom Camp of Kashmir, shops and businesses remained closed. Huge number of government forces were seen guarding the streets to avoid law and order problems. Almost seven decades ago, these laws were introduced to empower the Muslim majority of Kashmir. But today, when the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party is repealing and amending the same laws, the people of Kashmir are watching over helplessly. Experts say this move clearly depicts India's intentions in Kashmir. Shahana Butt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
This missing glaring concerns about voter intimidation, a Michigan judge on Tuesday, October 27th, struck down a directive from the Secretary of State banning the open carry of firearms at polling places on Election Day. The Associated Press reports Michigan Court of Claims Judge Christopher Murray granted a preliminary injunction in favor of gun rights advocates who had filed a lawsuit challenging an October 16 order from Democratic Secretary of State Jacqueline Benson declaring a universal ban on the open carry of guns within 100 feet of polling places on November 3rd. Armed far-right groups including the Oath Keepers and QAnon conspiracies have said they will heed Trump's call for an army of supporters to go into the polls and watch very carefully, which many observers say is nothing less than an endorsement of, if not a rallying call for, illegal voter intimidation. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Brett Wilkins, writer. This article is published under the heading, Michigan Judge Accused of Jeopardizing Safety and Democracy with Reversal of Open Carry Ban at Polling Places. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Dismissing glaring concerns about voter intimidation, a Michigan judge on Tuesday, October 27th, struck down a directive from the Secretary of the State banning the open carry of firearms at polling places on Election Day. The Associated Press reports Michigan Court of Claims Judge Christopher Murray granted a preliminary injunction in favor of gun rights advocates who had filed a lawsuit challenging an October 16th order from Democratic Secretary of State Jacqueline Benson declaring a universal ban on the open carry of guns within 100 feet of polling places on November 3rd. The injunction does not apply to places such as schools or churches that already prohibit open carry. Benson had argued that the ban was needed to deter voter intimidation in the wake of the revelation of a plot by far-right militia members who are supporters of President Donald Trump, to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, a Democrat. However, Murray asserted that Benson was attempting to create a new administrative rule without following the proper procedures. It is important to recognize that this case is not about whether it is a good idea to openly carry a firearm at polling place or whether the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution prevents the Secretary of State's directive, Murray wrote in his opinion. The court's duty is not to act as an overseer of the Michigan Department of State, nor it is to impose its view on the wisdom of openly carrying firearms at polling places or other election locations, wrote Murray. More importantly, its constitutional role is properly limited to only declaring what the law is, not what it should be. The secretary just didn't do this in the right way and at the right time, Murray said, adding that if she wanted to ban open carry at polling places, she should have done this months ago. The Detroit Free Press reports the State Assistant Attorney General Heather Mangast countered concerns regarding guns at polling places weren't as prevalent months ago as they are now, especially in light of the plot to kidnap the governor. Mangast said that now there are voters who are afraid. There are election workers who are afraid. Benson and Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel, also a Democrat, vowed to appeal Murray's injunction. As the state's chief elections officer, I have sworn duty to protect every voter and the right to cast the ballot free from intimidation and harassment, Benson said. I will continue to protect that right in Michigan. Armed far-right groups, including the Oath Keepers and QAnon conspiracists, have said they will heed Trump's call for an army of supporters to go into the polls and watch very carefully, which many observers say is nothing less than an endorsement of, if not a rallying call for, illegal voter intimidation. Stephen Gardiner, a scholar at the progressive think tank Political Research Associates, told The Guardian earlier this month that the militias will absolutely seize on Trump's comments. The possibility of armed factions with military-style rifles showing up at polling places is very troubling, Gardner said.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitan ar-rajim. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين الحمد لله الذي جعل الحمد مفتاحا لذكره وسببا للمزيد من رحمته ثم الصلاة والسلام على أشرف بريته حبيب إله العالمين أبي القاسم محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. قال الله في كتابه الكريم أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم فقال إن هذا إلا سحر يؤثر إن هذا إلا قول البشر سأصليه سقر وما أدراك ما سقر لا تبقي ولا تذر لواحة للبشر عليها 19 وما جعلنا أصحاب النار إلا ملائكة وما جعلنا عدتهم إلا فتنة للذين كفروا ليستيقن الذين أوتوا الكتاب ويزداد الذين آمنوا إيمانا ولا يرتاب الذين أوتوا الكتاب والمؤمنون وليقول الذين في قلوبهم مرض والكافرون ماذا أراد الله بهذا مثلا كذلك يضل الله من يشاء ويهدي من يشاء وما يعلم جنود ربك إلا هو وما هي إلا ذكرى للبشر. It's speaking about those who are questioning Allah, questioning what He has, what His orders, things like that. It says that this person, he went away disdainfully, saying it is nothing but magic, meaning the Quran is nothing but magic. But Allah says, soon I shall cast him into the Saqar. Allah continues, He says, and what do you know what the Saqar is? Who can show you what the Saqar is? It neither spares nor leaves. The Saqar, it burns the skin to a charcoal color. It's a reminder to all of us. It burns the skin. Now this is what we're going to deal with today, inshallah. The verse says, the verse that follows says, there are 19 keepers over this fire. 19 keepers. And then the next verse, which is the longest verse of this surah, Suratul Muddathir, this is the 30th verse. We have assigned only angels as keepers of the fire. And we have made their number merely a stumbling block for the faithless. And that those given the book may be reassured and the faithful may increase in faith. Until the end of the verse, where it says, those who don't have faith, they say, what did Allah mean by this description? 19? What does 19 mean? Until the end of the verse. In the beginning of the intro, you know, the Arabic lines that we always start with, we say, Habib Allah al-Alamin, to the Prophet, right? Question here. Why is the Prophet Habib Allah al-Alamin? Well, there's lots of different reasons to that, of course. But we have been ordered 5 times a day in our prayers to say one of the most important, if not the only, reason why he is Habib Allah al-Alamin, which is in our tashahud, of course. وَأَشْهَدُ أَنَّ مُحَمَّدًا عَبْدُهُ وَرَسُولُهُ عَبْدُهُ. Everything revolves around عَبْدُهُ.
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers. Open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true, and always tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide, an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here, who created us, who we must fear. So what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Coming back to the verse again, we need to be Abdullah. And that will not happen except through submission. I wanted to go get into the Khutbah Qasa a little bit, because that also, that is the sermon for these types of these things, these topics, this theme that we're covering. But I won't get to it. So it's your choice to be Abdullah or An-Nas Abidu Dunya, as Imam Hussein says. To be an Abd of the Dunya and take pleasure in these few days that we have here, and then leave this world. Abidu Dunya. That's about it, I would say. I think there's much more that there still needs to be covered, I would say, here, but because of lack of time, I will end it here. One point I would just like to make is very short about Imam al-Kadhim. We all know that He was one of the Imams that suffered very much at the hands of the ruler of his time. The same Bani Abbas who claimed, whose slogan was, when they rise against the Bani Umayyah, their claim, their slogan was, we are rising for the Prophet's household. But unfortunately, the Bani Abbas, these blood relatives of the Prophet, the cousins of the Prophet, ended up killing his grandsons and disrespecting them more than sometimes than the Bani Umayyah. Imam al-Qadim alayhi salam is famous for this, that he spent a lot of time in the prisons of Bani Abbas, of Harun al-Rashid la'natullahi alayhi. Harun al-Rashid, not only would he send him to prison, he would also disrespect our Imam. He would bring the Imam, he would take him out of his house, out of his home, he would, out of his prayer, bring him in the middle of the night sometimes maybe, and disrespect our Imam. Our Imam, in the prisons of Harun al-Rashid, he would thank Allah though. He would thank Allah for the opportunity of being isolated and alone and being able to do his worship and everything. But unfortunately, the last time that he was sent to the dungeon of Harun al-Rashid, it has been narrated that he asked Allah, oh Allah, khalisni min Harun. Save me from Harun. What was Harun doing to our Imam? Eventually our Imam was killed and martyred. And not only did that happen through poison, when they brought his pure body out, the agents and the officials of the caliphate, of the caliphate, what did they do? Not only did they kill our Imam, they bring him out and they call out, this is the Imam of the Rafida. Come and see him. Everyone, gather around and see the Imam of the Rafida. The same Imam that we stood up for, we put the Bani Umayyah aside because of, come see him. The same Imam we stood up for, now we have killed him. They didn't say that, of course, but this is what they mean. And not only did they say that, they carried the Imam's body, some say that on a board, disrespectfully. What do they say? They say, Ibn al-Khabith, come see him. The wretched, son of wretched, come and see him. What has our Imam done that they call him wretched, son of wretched? Not only did they call him a wretched person, they call his father, Imam al-Sadiq, a wretched person. Our salams and peace and blessings upon our dear Imam, Imam al-Qadim, the oppressive yet patient Imam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Ya Abul Hasan, Ya Musa ibn Ja'far, أيها الكاظم يا ابن رسول الله يا حجة الله على خلقه يا سيدنا ومولانا إنا توجهنا واستشفعنا وتوسلنا بك إلى الله وقدمناك بين يدي حاجاتنا يا وجيها عند الله اشفع لنا عند الله يا وجيها عند الله اشفع لنا.
I'm looking back throughout the years to breathe as hard, and my eyes are choked with tears. Your face and hair are full of light. Now it will soon be time to go. I feel you feeling calm now. Did the angel let you know?
That concludes this speech, alhamdulillah. I pray to Allah and ask Him that He helps us in His way, in the way of purifying the inside and our actions, inshallah, to His satisfaction. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Amid the confusion, the chaos and the pain, a man emerged and Muhammad was his name. And walking with nothing but Allah as his aid, and the mark of a prophet between his shoulder blades. In a cave in Mount Hira, the revelation came. Read, O Muhammad, read in Allah's name. May the blessings of Allah be on al-Mustafa. None besides him could have been al-Mujtaba. Muhammad, peace be upon his soul. The greatest of prophets, Islam was his only goal. بلغ العلا بكماله كشف الدجى بجماله حسن الجميع خصاله صلوا عليه وآله محمد peace be upon his soul. The greatest of prophets, Islam was his only goal.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
There will be, of course, an election day, and it could be one of tumult, banners colliding, incidents at the polls, and attempt at hacks galore. More likely than not, it will end without a winner named, or at least generally accepted. America will probably awaken on 4th of November into uncertainty. Whatever else happens, there is no doubt that President Trump is ready for it. I've spent the last month interviewing some 24 officials and aides, some of whom are still serving in the Trump administration. The central sources in this story are or were senior officials, mainly in jobs that require Senate confirmation. They have had regular access to President Donald Trump and to briefings at the highest level. As a rule, they ask for anonymity, because they were taking a significant professional and in some cases personal risk in speaking out in a way that Donald Trump will see as disloyal, an offense for which he has promised to make offenders pay. The article you're about to hear has been written by Ron Susskind, an investigative journalist with more than 3 decades experience writing for the New York Times. The piece is titled "The Day After Election Day: Current and Former Trump Administration Officials Are Worried About What Might Happen on 4th of November." Stay with us for more of Ron Susskind's article. There will, of course, be an election day, and it could be one of tumult, banners colliding, incidents at the polls, and attempted hacks galore. More likely than not, it will end without a winner named, or at least generally accepted. America will probably awaken on 4th of November into uncertainty. Whatever else happens, there is no doubt that President Trump is ready for it. I've spent the last month interviewing some 24 officials and aides, several of whom are still serving in the Trump administration. The central sources in this article are or were senior officials, mainly in jobs that require Senate confirmation. They have had regular access to President Donald Trump and to briefings at the highest level. As a rule, they ask for anonymity because they were taking a significant professional risk and in some cases personal risk in speaking out in a way that Donald Trump will see as disloyal, an offense for which he has promised to make offenders pay. Several of them are in current posts in intelligence, law enforcement, or national security, and are focused on the concurrent activities of violent far-right and white supremacy groups that have been encouraged by the president's words and actions. They are worried that the president could use the power of the government, the one they all serve or served within, to keep himself in office, or to create favorable terms for negotiating his exit from the White House. Like many other experts inside and outside of the government, they're also concerned about foreign adversaries using the internet to sow chaos, exacerbate divisions, and undermine America's democracy. Many of those adversaries, they report, are already finding success in simply amplifying and directing the president's words and tweets. And they're thoroughly delighted, a former top intelligence official told me, at how profoundly divided we've become. Donald Trump capitalized on that. He didn't invent it, but someday soon we're going to have to figure out how to bring our country together, because right now we're on a dangerous path, so very dangerous and so vulnerable to bad actors. None of these officials know what will happen in the future any better than the rest of us do. It is their job to fret over worst-case scenarios, and they're damn good at it. I can't know all their motives for wanting to speak to me, but one thing many of them share is a desire to make clear that the alarm bells held across the country are ringing loudly inside the administration too, where there are public servants looking to avert conflict at all costs. It is possible, of course, that this will be an election day much like all other election days. Even if it takes weeks or months before the result is known and fully certified, it could be a peaceful process where all votes are reasonably counted, allowing those precious electors to be distributed based on a fair fight. The anxiety we're feeling now could turn out to be a lot of fretting followed by nothing much, a political version of Y2K. Or not, of course. Many of those officials I spoke to came back to one idea. You don't know Donald Trump like we do. Even though they can't predict exactly what will happen, their concerns range from the president welcoming then leveraging foreign interference in the election to encouraging havoc that grows into conflagrations that would merit his calling upon U.S. forces, U.S. military forces. Because he's now surrounded by loyalists, they say, there is no one to try to tell an impulsive man what he should or shouldn't do. That guy you saw in the debate, a second former senior intelligence official told me after the first presidential debate, when the president offered one of the most astonishing performances of any leader in modern American history, bullying, ridiculing, manic boasting, fabricating relentlessly, interrupting and talking over his opponent, that's really him, not the myth that he's been created. That's Trump. Still another senior government official who spent years working in proximity to Donald Trump put it like this. He has done nothing else that's a constant except for acting in his own interest. And that's how he's going to be thinking every step of the way come 3rd of November. One of the first things that senior staff members learnt about President Donald Trump was that he was all but unbriefable. He couldn't seem to take in complex information about policy choices and consequences in the ways presidents usually do in the Oval Office. What they saw instead was a guy from the first debate. He'd switch subjects, go on crazy tangents, abuse and humiliate people, cut them off mid-sentence. Officials I interviewed described this scenario again and again. In the middle of the briefing, Donald Trump would turn away and grab the phone. Sometimes the call would go on to Fox television hosts like Sean Hannity or Lou Dobbs. Sometimes the officials wouldn't even know who was on the other end of the phone, but whoever it was would instantly become the key voice in the debate. In one meeting about the border wall, Donald Trump called a person who built a flagpole at one of his golf courses, said an official in attendance that day. Mr. Trump explained that because this person got in a big fight about the size of the flagpole and because it was really big, the president thought, of course, they would understand how to build a wall. Obviously, this official said, it is not the same. We used to joke that it was like a phone a friend thing, a lifeline thing. From Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, this person said. Soon senior officials, frustrated that they couldn't seem to get a word in during briefings, adopted their own version of this technique. They'd ask an array of people, some Trump friends, some members of Congress, assorted notables, to call Mr. Trump and talk to him about key issues. The callers just couldn't let on that a senior official had put them up to it. Two of these senior officials compared the technique to the manipulation of the Truman Show, in which the main character, played by Jim Carrey, does not know that his entire life is being orchestrated by a television producer. In February 2019, William Barr arrived as Attorney General, having auditioned for the job with a 19-page memo, arguing in various and creative ways that the president's powers should be exercised nearly without limits, and his actions stand virtually beyond review. He stood ready to brilliantly manage the receipt of the Mueller report in March. William Barr's move constituted what amounted to a clean kill, decapitating the sprawling nearly two-year investigation led by his old friend with a single blow. That summer, two more heavyweight senior officials, Dan Coats, the Director of National Intelligence, and his deputy Sue Gordon, a beloved 32-year veteran of the CIA, both resigned. to replace Dan Coats, Donald Trump's elected representative, John Ratcliffe of Texas, a small-town mayor turned congressman with no meaningful experience in intelligence, who quickly withdrew from consideration after news reports questioned his qualifications for the post. He lacked support among key Republican senators as well. Donald Trump then picked a communications official in the administration of George W. Bush and ambassador to Germany under Mr. Trump, Richard Grenell. Richard Grenell's stint was temporary, and in May, Donald Trump brought back his first choice, Mr. Ratcliffe, who is now Director of National Intelligence, for Mr. Trump's home stretch and post-election period. In other words, by the summer of 2020, Donald Trump was well along in completing the transition to a loyalty-tested senior team. When I asked the White House to respond to this idea, I heard back from Sarah Matthews, a deputy press secretary at the White House. President Trump serves the American people by keeping his promises and taking action where a typical politician would provide hollow words, she said. The president wants capable public servants in his administration who will enact his America First agenda and are faithful to the Constitution. These principles are not mutually exclusive. President Trump is delivering on his promise to make Washington accountable again to the citizens it meant to serve, and will always fight for what is best for the American people. The reason having loyalists at both the Department of Justice and DNI is so very important for the president is that it allows him potentially to coordinate two key agencies of the government, secret intelligence and prosecution, towards his own political ends. This is exactly what he was criticized for doing in the summer and in autumn of 2020, with William Barr being accused of announcing politically motivated action and investigations, including to support the fiction of widespread voter fraud, and Mr. Ratcliffe with collecting and releasing information that is targeting Donald Trump's political opponents. The third leg of what would be an ideal triad for this sort of activity is the FBI director, Christopher Wray, who drew Donald Trump's ire in September when in congressional hearings he echoed the consensus of the intelligence community that the Russians intervened in the 2016 presidential election on Mr. Trump's behalf, that they were doing it again in this election cycle, that racially motivated violent extremism coming mostly from right-wing white supremacists was a persistent threat, and that widespread voter fraud was a non-issue. The FBI has been under siege since this past summer, according to a senior official who spoke on the condition of anonymity. The White House is using friendly members of Congress to try to get at certain information under the guise of quote-unquote oversight, but really to get politically helpful information about the election, the official said.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.